I'm Jeffrey Church from the Department of Political Science at the University of Houston. This is the Political Theory Review, a podcast of conversations with authors of recent books in political theory and social and political philosophy. Today, I'm talking to Paul Franco, Barry N. Wish Professor of Government and Social Studies at Bowdoin College. We're discussing his 2021 book, Rousseau, Nietzsche, and the Image of the Human, from the University of Chicago Press. Franco works on late modern political thought, especially the works of Oakeshott, Hegel, Nietzsche, and Strauss, and has published many books on and articles on these thinkers. Well, first of all, Paul Franco, thank you so much for joining me on the Political Theory Review.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Paul, I love this book. I mean, how could I not? It's on Rousseau and Nietzsche, and you know, penetrating readings of both thinkers, bringing them together in a kind of dialogue and applying them to the contemporary world. This is my kind of bread and butter too. So I, you know, I loved reading it, and I thank you for the book. Let me say that first and foremost. But let me also ask you, you know, just to start us off, you know, what was the motivation for writing this book in the first place? Why did you pick Rousseau and Nietzsche?
Yeah. Well, I suppose I've always been interested in critiques of liberalism. I may be, at the end of the day, even though I've written on, for example, Hegel, I've always found myself a little bit more interested in the critics of liberalism than the defenders. And in my view, Rousseau and Nietzsche really constitute the two most profound critics, I think, of the liberal tradition. And they do so in a way that speaks to one another. They're certainly thinkers that share that critical perspective, but they obviously, Nietzsche is engaged with Rousseau, oftentimes in a very polemically negative and critical way, and in a way that sometimes conceals just how much he owes to Rousseau's first and greatest criticism of Enlightenment liberalism. So I guess, yeah, the bottom line is, I think they are the two greatest, most profound critics of Enlightenment liberalism. And those criticisms, I think we can learn from both of them. And I think we can learn from both of them as they converse with or brought into conversation with one another as well.
Good, yeah. I mean, I guess my first quest or set of questions is about, you know, the more dry subject, I guess, of scholarship before getting into the actual substance. But I guess I, you know, maybe just to get us started, I mean, these are two extremely frequently discussed philosophers. Maybe you could just say a little bit briefly about what you take to be the, you know, contribution of the book. That is, the, you know, what is it that you're adding to the conversation about these two thinkers and their relationships to one another. I mean, I must say, you know, I don't say this in a criticism, because I've found a lot of your readings and particular parts of the book to be very novel, and we'll get to those in particular. But I, you know, wonder if you could say something, you know, sort of general about, you know, where this book stands vis-a-vis the sort of ongoing conversation about these philosophers.
Yeah, in some ways it was a, and I mean, again, I'm talking to someone who's very much a contributor to these thinkers and to this kind of late modern moment. So, you know, this scholarship as well as anyone, and have contributed to it. Daunting project insofar as there's been so much written on each of these thinkers. I myself probably come to this more from the Nietzsche side than the Rousseau side. And Rousseau I do think that the genesis of the project really was more from the Nietzsche side than from the Rousseau side. And I think probably at the end of the day, if I were being totally honest about it, I feel like probably my reading of of Nietzsche is more original than that of Rousseau. The scholarship on the two of these thinkers together is, you know, actually surprising. And I think we always find this, that you'd think that nothing could be more natural than to bring Rousseau and Nietzsche into conversation with one another, for the reasons I gave before, that they just really are kind of two peas in a pod as far as criticisms of the Enlightenment and of liberalism are concerned. You know, there really isn't a great deal written on the two thinkers. I think there's more than a couple of books, but I mean the I think major contribution was by Ansel Pearson from, you know, almost 30 years ago, a book from 1990 or 1991 on Nietzsche contra Rousseau. And then before that, there was, I think the other major contribution to this dialogue would be a book by a guy whose first name is going to escape me, but his last name is Williams. And he was a kind of a French literature scholar. But apart from that, there are some scattered articles, but not a great deal written on the two of them. And as I wrote the book, I kind of realized why. It's just partly just the immensity of trying to bring them together, I think is extremely challenging. I think both with respect to not only Williams and Ansel Pearson, but really others in general, I think the standard move in discussing these two authors has been, okay, Nietzsche has this is very critical about Rousseau, takes him as one of his chief, you know, polemical antagonists. And most commentators then usually say, but you know what, in the end, he's not as different from Rousseau as he claims to be. And in fact, they share a great deal in common. And I think all of that is not totally untrue. I'd say probably the distinctiveness of my interpretation is that I go one step further and say, while that is all true, I do think at the end of the day, the differences between these two thinkers probably are more interesting and profound than other writers have or other commentators have made out to be, and that's where I kind of want to focus my attention, without neglecting the commonalities between them.
Good, and you know, maybe you could say a little bit at just the beginning here about you know, Nietzsche's own reading of Rousseau. That is, you know, sort of what did he read of Rousseau, and how did his, you know, his own views of Rousseau change over time? Obviously, Rousseau didn't read Nietzsche. That would have been an interesting take. But, you know, so the time's arrow only lets us talk about one of these thinkers' take on the other. But I mean, this is to say, much of your book is about, you know, sort of comparing and contrasting the views. But just as a sort of way to get us started, you know, thinking about, you know, how Nietzsche himself thought about the dialogue between the two of them. What does that look like?
Absolutely. It does. I think there is a certain development there. And I think, again, I couldn't be talking to someone who probably is as aware, more aware of that development than you, Jeff, because of course, one of his earliest and most important discussions of Rousseau appears in the essay Schopenhauer as Educator, which is, of course, where the title of my book comes from. There's a passage in Schopenhauer as Educator where Nietzsche talks about the need to reconstruct the image of the human, of the human being. And he mentions that there have been three key kind of modern contributions to the construction of the image of the human, and Rousseau's is one of those. Goethe and Schopenhauer are the other other two. And so there's a way in which there, in Schopenhauer's Educator, Nietzsche does pay homage to Rousseau. However, the particular image he ascribes to Rousseau there begins to suggest the kind of criticism that Nietzsche is going to be making for the rest of his career. He kind of characterizes Rousseau's image of the human being as one of a kind of revolutionary overthrower of what is so dissatisfying and unnatural in the modern world. So there's a kind of Rousseau as heir, you know, kind of not heir to the French Revolution, as progenitor of the French Revolution, and someone who uses his idea of the state of nature as a kind of wedge to illustrate all that's wrong with the world as it is. And it's that kind of revolutionary Rousseau that Nietzsche seems to already have some problems with. And for all of his admiration of Rousseau, and it's that that kind of deepens as he goes along. And it's really then we see in the middle works the deepening of his hostility to Rousseau as Nietzsche develops his critique of morality, or begins to focus his critique of modernity on morality. He sees Rousseau as kind of central to that moralistic enterprise in 18th century Europe. And that's where there is in Daybreak, another key aphorism is one which is entitled Contra Rousseau, very conveniently. And it's in that aphorism that he says, you know, if you think you can either think of our bad civilization as producing our bad morality, or like Rousseau does, or you can think of our good morality as producing our bad civilization, which Nietzsche suggests is his point of view. And there you do begin to see that Nietzsche contra Rousseau, the kind of boxing match between Nietzsche and Rousseau begins in earnest from that point. And Nietzsche's comments about Rousseau from that point on tend to get increasingly more negative. Many of those are to be found in his notebooks, but he begins to see Rousseau, who was the tarantula, the moral tarantula who bit Kant, that produced in some ways the moralism against which Nietzsche is so vehemently opposed in his later writings. So that's really kind of where I, just to go back to an earlier question, I have to say that probably my own interest in this topic began by reading those Nietzschean comments on Rousseau and seeing that there was something important at stake there for Nietzsche, and also that those polemical comments probably didn't do complete justice to the richness of the dialogue between them.
Right. So is it fair to summarize your view? Because I've often wondered this: why exactly Nietzsche really does change his. I mean, it seems this is a kind of change, because I do agree that he's very almost celebratory of Rousseau and Schopenhauer's Educator, but he really does become very critical. And I've often wondered why that is. So is it fair to summarize that, you know, sort of the early period work, he's much more concerned with modern science and its effect on, you know, the modern state and so forth, and its effect on the sort of problems of modernity. But he comes to appreciate much more the kind of the way in which morality, especially Christian morality, is it kind of underlies that problem kind of in this middle and late period, and then comes to see Rousseau really as the kind of heir to this, you know, the slave morality ultimately, the way in which he ushers in an era of, well, the movements of socialism and so forth that are really kind of taking off in Nietzsche's day, that he thinks are the sort of the ultimate effects here of Christianity. And so you see, you know, it's by focusing on Rousseau, it's at once a recognition that this guy, as you say, is as a kind of watershed moment in modernity, but also, you know, kind of comes to recognize that he's actually more responsible for some of the woes than he originally conceived.
Absolutely. No, I think that I do think that the shift to morality as in some ways the central culprit in the unfolding of modernity is very much behind the shift, you know, in Nietzsche's attitude toward Rousseau. I do, and this is, you know, I wonder what you think. Again, we can make this a dialogue here, because I really do. Your work has obviously been something that I've learned a great deal from, in thinking about both Nietzsche and Rousseau. I mean, you've written them both. You know, the Schopenhauer's educator, and this is a work you've done a lot of work on. I still see there. Would you agree that when he talks about Rousseau's image of the human being there, the kind of hostility to the Rousseauan political project seems to be at least part of his understanding, critical understanding of Rousseau. Nietzsche, this is kind of the Rousseau who lies behind the French Revolution. And as far as I can tell, Nietzsche never really seemed to warm to the French Revolution in the way that that Hegel, for example, did.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, you know, in this, I mean, he admires the passion in Rousseau, and there's a sort of quasi, you know, evocations of, you know, the kind of Dionysian element in Rousseau's thinking, and uses the term Erdbeben. He's like a, you know, an earthquake that sort of unsettles the world, and so Nietzsche very much, yeah, appreciates that. But there's also, right, I mean, I think you're right about this, that there's a worry that the after effects of this passion are going to have are going to result in a kind of society that's not conducive to the pursuit of excellence. So yeah, he's just the first image of the human, not the, you know, not the complete one. And of course, somebody like Goethe is limited as well. I mean, he's got the, you know, he's the contrasting figure, the cosmopolitan as opposed to the nationalist type of figure in Rousseau. Yes. But he's too removed from a kind of national self-consciousness, right? So it's, you know, I see those images of the human as sort of complementary figures rather than, you know, each one being sort of self-sufficient unto themselves. That's why he wants to have those three, and they sort of reflect the three types of history and the second unfashionable observation. But anyway, this is about your book, Paul. I appreciate, you know, this is very nice of you to ask me.
I was going to add one more thing, if I could, just in terms of, I actually do think, especially in that with respect to the untimely meditations or the unfashionable observations that you've written on, there is, apart from just the more explicit mentions of Rousseau, there are just so many echoes, Rousseauan echoes in those works. And for me, especially when Nietzsche talks about, in Schopenhauer's Educator, for example, and the uses and disadvantages of history, you know, when he talks about honesty, for example, and a certain kind of sincerity and trying to not be, you know, sucked into the conventions of the day and to be true to yourself, there I just see so much of an echo of Rousseau without his necessarily naming Rousseau explicitly.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, a lot of the, you know, you could say the kind of general architecture of the way that Rousseau thinks, right, having a kind of a condition of the state of nature in which human beings are kind of like animals, but yet a kind of falling away from that, and the kind of moral imperatives that then one tries to recapture from the state of nature to guide one into the future. I'm thinking, you know, at the beginning of Schopenhauer's Educator, you know, Nietzsche has these reflections about the homogenizing effect of public opinion and the need to kind of be true to yourself and so forth. I think that Nietzsche adopts a very kind of Rousseauan architecture to his thinking, even if, as you say in your book, I mean, he departs in some of the kind of basic account of, you know, human nature and so forth, but that, I think that basic structure is there, a kind of original immediacy, state of immediacy in human nature, a falling away, and then an attempt at a kind of eventual redemption, is. But then again, I think Rousseau penetrates all of German philosophy, so one would expect this.
Absolutely. And what you say about the architecture, I think this too was one of the things that captivated me about the two. I think it's if you teach these authors, as we often do in our classes, it almost leaps out at you that, you know, when you look at, just here are these two critics of kind of the modern world, their criticisms focus on roughly the same things. And of course, they then kind of develop their critique through this genealogy, whereby you imagine some point in the past from which we have fallen off a little more unambiguously in Rousseau than in Nietzsche, and then somehow can possibly retrieve a healthier relationship to ourselves and the world. Absolutely parallel. So the first chapter of my book, you know, I think captures precisely that isomorphism in their philosophies by focusing on their two genealogies of in the second discourse of Rousseau, and of course in the genealogy of morality of Nietzsche.
Yeah, good. So that's a good transition to talk about that, because you start in the, you know, in the first chapter on their negative projects, paralleling them before following in the latter half of the book on their positive projects, sort of comparing and contrasting them. So yeah, maybe you could say a little bit about, the genealogical accounts in Rousseau and Nietzsche, you know, sort of, you could talk first about Rousseau's view and what you take to be his sort of contribution to, you know, genealogical critique of modern Enlightenment society. And then we can then, you know, turn to Nietzsche and compare and contrast.
Yeah, as far as Rousseau is concerned, I use these. I was struck that in reading Rousseau that he actually uses this phrase that he has written a genealogy of vice, and I was much taken with the juxtaposition of his genealogy of vice with, of course, the title of one of Nietzsche's books, the Genealogy of Morality. And I use these genealogies, these two genealogies, to both bring out, along the lines of what we were just talking about, the kind of that historical moment where these thinkers see human beings as being somewhat more in touch with their natures, and then how civilization and history has somehow corrupted that original pristine human nature. So with respect to Rousseau, of course, I talk first about his understanding of human nature in terms of the master thesis of the natural goodness of human beings, which he lays out in the first part of the second discourse. And of course, you know, the probably the stereotype would be that somehow Rousseau's, you know, hopelessly sentimental in his reconstruction of the natural human being and the state of nature, in contrast to Nietzsche's much more, you know, kind of dark view about the aggressive nature of human beings. But of course, we know that's a very simplified, oversimplified view of Rousseau, that his understanding of natural goodness is really an understanding which sees human beings as naturally, you know, amoral brutes, really, amoral animals, that there's a strong animalistic understanding of original human nature in Rousseau, which again, I think brings him a little bit closer to Nietzsche, makes him much more comparable than the stock kind of primitivist understanding of Rousseau, which you suggest. And so I trace that in Rousseau, try to say a little bit more about what exactly the natural goodness of human beings actually consists in for Rousseau, and then to show the way in which in the second half of the second discourse, he shows us falling away from that natural goodness, and focusing, you know, kind of, I don't give an exhaustive account of Rousseau's genealogy of vice. I really try to show that the key moment for Rousseau, as is suggested by the very first paragraph in the second part of the second discourse, that the invention of property and the acceleration or the exacerbation of inequality and the bad things that come from social inequality is really the pivotal moment that Rousseau identifies as far as the downfall of humanity is concerned, and really the problem with modernity more generally. And so that, so much for Rousseau there, moved to Nietzsche, and I use as my focal.
Sorry to interrupt, just before you move to Nietzsche, I mean, just because I appreciated on the Rousseau side of things, you know, the sort of complication of the view of natural goodness of human beings, because, you know, the second discourse gives one impression, I think, of, you know, the sort of condition of nature, but, you know, the Emile gives a sort of deeper, you know, account of this. I often find Larry Cooper very helpful on Rousseau on this matter as well, because one of the things Larry's emphasized, and I wonder what you make of it, is that, you know, there's this emphasis in the Emile on the sort of the idea that the expansion of our being, right, because this is connected to, you know, Rousseau talks about how human beings want to expand our being, in part because then once we expand our being, then you can get a fuller account of the sentiment of our existence. If our being is expanded, then we can sense our existence a little bit more. And, you know, this is connected with his, you know, those moments in the meal where Rousseau says things, you know, he's talking about babies and how babies scream and cry because they want to sort of expand their being and get power over their, you know, so this, you know, it sounds a lot like the will to power, right? I mean, at the heart in Rousseau, there's a being has a desire to expand its being, as it were.
Yeah. First of all, I really admire Larry Cooper's first book on Rousseau, which tries to give a more enriched understanding of what nature means for Rousseau, partly in terms of this this idea of the expansion of being. So I think he, you know, in some ways, a little bit at odds with, I think, the typical Straussian view of the second discourse and the status of nature in that work. And I do think I follow Larry much more closely in this regard, that the state of nature, even in the second discourse, I don't think there's much of it. I don't even think that there's necessarily a change here. I've always understood the understanding of nature in the state of nature of the second discourse to be kind of a, you know, not a complete teaching about the fulfillment of human nature might look like. It's a kind of departure point and something that has to be borne in mind and is particularly good as a benchmark to measure our regress, but not necessarily in any sense an ideal to aspire to. I mean, there are certain features I do think that are remain for Rousseau as that he describes in the state of nature that remain key for him, the kind of self-sufficiency and independence and self-dependence that belongs to the savage in the state of nature remain kind of constant features throughout his treatment of the natural human being, even in Mimile. But it doesn't account for the kind of expansion of our capacities that you've referred to, and that Larry Cooper does an amazing job at dealing with. We should mention Larry Cooper is one of these. I actually didn't mention him. He's written a book that is kind of a book about Nietzsche and Rousseau. It also involves Plato as well. And I probably take a little bit less from that from that book, and I'm a little less persuaded of the identification of Rousseau's expansion of being and Nietzsche's will to power. I mean, there's a kind of maybe formal similarity there, but I think at the end of the day, they're quite different notions. But anyway, we should mention Larry Cooper because he did write a book that's very different from my book, but does take Rousseau and Nietzsche as two of the three thinkers he wants to bring in conversation with one another.
Yes, I was like mentioning Larry. So Larry, if you're out there, well done, sir.
Thank you, Larry.
I think the one substantive point, I think, you know, the second discourse versus the Emile question, continuity versus discontinuity, I think, you know, it's raised in your chapter here in the point about the sort of artificiality of amour propre, right? So, you know, in the second discourse, Rousseau makes a point to talk about how artificial amour propre is. It's not a natural occurrence, it's sort of creation of our freedom or whatever. Whereas, you know, in the Emile, it's much more, I mean, I think you even quote this part where, you know, so sort of it was almost inevitable to develop, you know, I mean, this has often been a puzzle for me. I mean, actually what to make of, you know, Rousseau's view on this matter, because it's important, right? I mean, if something like our pride is natural to human beings, that sort of questions the sort of natural, or at least it complicates the natural goodness thesis that the responsibility for our evils are all on our shoulders, right? That then you get more of a view, I think, which you get more in German philosophy, which is that there's a need also to redeem nature, not just redeem our own errors. But I don't know what you make of that apparent.
Well, I think it's very important, and it's been kind of, I think, one of the more interesting developments in Rousseau scholarship in the last, 15 or 20 years. And again, I think Larry Cooper's one of those people who's done a lot to bring out the importance of amour propre, not simply as, you know, kind of the source of all that's gone bad, but in some ways as something that that is unavoidable and in some ways incredibly crucial to living a full and fully realized life. So Larry Cooper's one of those, and I suppose the other, you know, the very famous Richard Dent was another one of these authors that did much to recuperate the notion, the positive understanding of a more appropriate. And then I think probably the person who's done more than almost anyone else is Richard is Frederick Neuhauser in his two books on Rousseau, both of which I think are very good. You again, because we're in this, we're plowing the same field. Know Neuhauser from his work on Hegel as well. And there is a way in which, apropos of what you've just said, his Rousseau is one that if amour propre is to be taken much more seriously and taken much more seriously as a positive building block in the formation of the human being. That's a Rousseau that gestures toward Kant and Hegel, especially Hegel, more than has been grasped prior to this. So, yeah, I think there's. I too think that this is a very important development in Rousseau's scholarship, and it does kind of complicate things. Maybe it does suggest, I may have been a little too flip in saying that there's really, the second discourse says it all, and there hasn't been much development even as you move into the Emile. Maybe there is something, a deepening there that goes a little bit beyond the second discourse. So this can be one of those things you just edit out that first comment of mine and...
Oh, that's great. Yeah, well, but I interrupted you when you were going to transition over to Nietzsche. I mean, I'm interested in, yeah, I mean, so how do you take Nietzsche's sort of genealogical critique of modernity to, you know, be similar to, different from Rousseau's?
You know, this is so, you know, as often happens when we write these books and write these chapters, you know, there seemed like an obvious comparison to be made with, you know, between, again, the account of the second discourse and in some ways the account of Nietzsche's in the genealogy of morality. They at least architecturally or formally have a similar structure. So it seemed like a great idea. But the more I got into it, the more complicated it became because, you know, Rousseau's story is relatively straightforward. Relatively straightforward. Nietzsche's is really not so straightforward. In fact, just even figuring out the chronology of Nietzsche's genealogy and the genealogy of morality turns out to be much more complicated than at least I imagined when I first began thinking about this chapter. And of course, he doesn't go back. I mean, the first thing to be noticed as a difference with Rousseau is that, of course, Nietzsche doesn't go back to some sort of pre-political, pre-social understanding of humanity as his starting point, but actually begins, you know, with human beings in some sort of association with one another. Actually, here too, as I'm getting down this, the other thing that made Nietzsche so complicated from my point of view is that I was very interested, given my interest in Nietzsche's middle works, in bringing together the kind of genealogical accounts that Nietzsche gives in the middle works about the morality of mores, the morality of custom, and the development of humanity from that point. And then the account in the genealogy of morality, which is somewhat different. So in the middle works, you begin, Nietzsche begins his genealogy with the morality of custom, in which, you know, very different from Rousseau, you have human beings in a kind of straitjacket that custom creates, that here is a humanity that is social already and imperiled. And in some ways, what is necessary is to batten down the hatches and to keep people absolutely clamped down for the enterprise to go forward. So you can't, one could not think of a sharper contrast in some ways between that account of the you know, kind of starting point in Nietzsche from that of Rousseau. Genealogy of morality has some of those same features, certainly, and especially in the second treatise or essay of the genealogy of morality. But what makes the genealogy of morality very interesting to compare with Rousseau is that there is also this reconstruction of the knightly morality that eventually gets overturned by the slave morality introduced by the priests and Judaism and Christianity. And that to me is interesting because there we do actually see Nietzsche, somewhat in contrast with middle works, creating a moment that does seem to be somewhat have some normative purchase to it. Something that a little bit along the lines of Rousseau, you can kind of hark back to as a moment where, you know, humanity had a healthier relationship to its nature, its will to power, than what came after. Likewise, of course, I think this is again very similar to Rousseau, that Nietzsche doesn't simply idealize that initial moment of knightly morality. He realizes that there's something, while humanity in some ways had a more natural relationship to its nature, there's something crude and simple and uninteresting about that starting point along the lines that that there was something uninteresting and undeveloped and crude about the savage in Rousseau's second discourse. And again, we see that for Nietzsche, there is a way in which the downfall or the things that lead to the downfall of humanity also contain within them the seeds of a more interesting development for humanity in the future. Very similar again to what we were talking about in Rousseau with Amor Propre, that there is a way that the ressentiment that drives Nietzsche's story forward, as you know, and as is often remarked, that there is a way in which it, while it led to some very bad things, it also contains within it a kind of seed bed for an even subtler and higher development down the road. So all of that, when you look at the genealogy of morality, especially the formal kind of similarities to Rousseau, I think come out very clearly. Of course, the content, the actual things that they're talking about as far as what human nature consists of and what leads to our falling away from it, I think differ profoundly. No natural goodness in Nietzsche. And will to power, of course, being certainly not, and this is where I guess I differ from Larry Cooper, the will to power as Nietzsche understands it, not in Rousseau.
Yeah, that's good. So I, in the interest of time, because I think we could talk about the Negative Project all day long, but the I wanted to turn to your account of the positive projects in both Rousseau and Nietzsche. And you talk about the, you have three chapters, one on the self, one on women and the family, and one on politics. I certainly want to get to the one on politics. I think I'm contractually obliged from this podcast. But to talk about the self first, because this is in some ways, I mean, it's kind of, I think, follows from what we've just been talking about. And, you know, because in part, it seems to me, what, you know, Rousseau and Nietzsche are after is to try to develop a, you know, a normative ethics that doesn't rely on nature anymore, right? Because nature doesn't provide, certainly, it doesn't provide us a clear path toward, you know, a kind of natural law that we could follow, that would give us a sort of indication for what a full or complete life is. But instead, it has to be a sort of a view of a human freedom, a kind of a self, a self-constructed self that provides us with some of the kind of guidance. And so see this, you know, Rousseau's view, often discussed view of authenticity. And I want to get your take on that, you know, this sort of view of Rousseau and the authentic self, but also in Nietzsche, the kind of the view of the self as a sort of artistic project, the sort of aesthetic conception of self-making. So maybe you could start with Rousseau, and you know, you talk about Charles Taylor in your chapter, and you know, what do you make of the view of Rousseau as conceiving of the self as aiming fundamentally at authenticity?
So yeah, I mean, I'd say the you know, the big, I'd say the big contrast I draw between Rousseau, well, first of all, just to of course. Nietzsche and Rousseau are often seen as two of the, maybe the two key thinkers in the development of this idea of sincerity or authenticity, if they're sincerity and authenticity, if you think there's a difference between those two things. And so obviously two really important people to, given that that is a continues to be, you know, an absolutely central ethical ideal in modern life, in my view, very crucial to look at these two thinkers and their contribution to that ideal. So they're similar in that way. And they, again, you could look at many passages in both of them, you know, where they sound virtually the same. And I quote some of those, you know, where basically it is, you know, be yourself. Don't try to see yourself in others, or sort of model yourself on kind of what the expectations of society are, but be true to yourself, and hence the term authenticity. For all those similarities, though, I do draw a fundamental contrast between the two of these thinkers. And I guess for me, the central difference lies in the fact that for Rousseau, authenticity ultimately is something that is not only compatible with morality, but in some ways absolutely constituted by morality. That for Rousseau, the authentic self is the virtuous self, the self that is in some ways completely self-dependent insofar as its desires do not outstrip its ability to satisfy those desires, a kind of wholeness that goes along with that, and that morality is absolutely crucial for that kind of self-mastery, self-dependence and self-wholeness. Nietzsche, on the other hand, I think is his understanding of authenticity is diametrically opposed to that. That morality, as we've talked about before, is for him is the culprit. The self and its development really requires a constant, not mastery over our desires, or at least not mastery over our desires in the way that Rousseau conceives of it. But as you put it, in the first instance, as a kind of aesthetic management of our drives and desires and affects. But of course, I think for the other side of the other thing I want to bring out, somewhat in contrast with other Nietzsche scholars, is that the aesthetic itself is not really the end of Nietzsche's reflections on the authenticity of the self, that the aesthetic self-management of the self is in some ways to be subordinated to the constant, tearing up of the beautiful patterns and harmonies that we create, and constantly kind of moving on and not settling for a kind of satisfied contemplation of our aesthetic unity or aesthetic symmetry, but the kind of dissatisfaction that comes with from time to time leaving that unity behind and trying to achieve something different and new.
Yeah, and I mean, connected with that, I love your discussion of the way in which that what you just described distinguishes Nietzsche from a kind of Millian, John Stuart Mill type romantic conception that sometimes Nietzsche scholars are tempted by, that this is a kind of an ideal that's widely, able to be widely applied. Just everybody can craft their lives according to sort of an aesthetic ideal. What you just described is it's extremely difficult to achieve, right? I mean, maybe you could just say a little bit about, how distinguish, Nietzsche's view of kind of aesthetic ideal from a John Stuart Mill type of view.
Yeah. Well, first, just to maybe we're not being entirely fair to old John Stuart Mill. He may see it as not utterly easy either. But I think for let me just think about this for a second. How I'd frame the difference between them in this regard. I suppose I'd put, and here I'm thinking a little bit more on my feet, but to me the difference lies really in the emphasis on suffering in Nietzsche versus Mill. That for Nietzsche there is a way in which the highest self, the most comprehensive human being, the greatest human being, is one that's able to encompass the greatest amount of variety, to incorporate the most multifarious aspects of the self, and somehow not be destroyed by that. And that enterprise of kind of constantly trying to incorporate diverse, different, contrasting, contradictory aspects of the self is one that is arduous, as you say, and is a consummate achievement for the person who can somehow manage that. And of course, it's in this connection that Nietzsche, I think most often, if he's not talking about in some ways the Übermensch, himself, you know, often talks about Goethe, and bringing us back to something we were talking about earlier. One of the things that I find interesting about Nietzsche is the way his image of Goethe changes over the course of time, too. So in Schopenhauer's Educator, he kind of comes off as a cosmopolitan world traveler, someone who kind of, you know, just kind of takes it all in and contemplates, you know, kind of the cosmopolitan wonders of the world. Of course, in his later writings, Goethe does become, I think, much more identified with this idea of the self that is a unity in multiplicity, a kind of a unity that has the greatest amount of diversity contained within it. And again, to bring it back to what I was talking about, it is the incorporation of that diversity that leads to the kind of suffering and self-overcoming that is absolutely central to Nietzsche's idea of the authentic self. I don't see any of that really in John's Stuart Mill. And there is in Mill, there are those moments in, say, On Liberty, where he does talk about, when he's criticizing Calvinists, you know, where he talks about those impulses and energies that we need to not simply slough off or extirpate, but need to somehow use in a productive way. There's a little bit of a glimpse toward what Nietzsche is talking about there, but of course it's developed so much more profoundly and extremely and interestingly, I think, in Nietzsche than in Mill.
Yeah, and I wanted to circle back to what you said about Rousseau, because, you know, so I think it's right to say that, you know, sort of virtue characterizes his, you know, ideal of authenticity, you could say, in, you know, especially in the Emile and the social contract. But I'm also thinking, you know, so in some ways, you know, you could draw a line from Rousseau to Kant, say, with the idea of autonomy is obeying a kind of general law and developing one's virtue. But isn't there also, can't you also say that, you know, there's a line from Rousseau to romanticism of John Stuart Mill and Nietzsche, which is, you can see in the sort of Reveries and Solitary Walker and the other kind of, you know, more solitary works where, you know, the ideal of authenticity is precisely, I guess you could say for Rousseau, kind of antisocial type of view. It doesn't involve virtue. It involves much more of getting in touch with the, I don't know, you know, the harmonies and the rhythms of one's own being, or however you want to put it. What do you make of that?
Well, I think that is a really important point, and kind of points to what I think is where I differ from a number of other commentators, and probably ones that we're both very familiar with. I would say those commentators like Arthur Melzer, for example, or Leo Strauss himself, to tell you the truth, in which the Reveries, or Heinrich Meyer, to take maybe the most extreme example, you know, where the Reveries does take on in some ways a special status in Rousseau's oeuvre, transcending the moralistic Rousseau of the social contract and the Emile, and really does capture in some ways that romantic idea of the solitary artist, you know, who's completely isolated from society and kind of cultivates his own kind of distinctive wholeness. You know, and you may have noticed this, I tend to treat the Reveries as, by the way, Heinrich Meyer is another one of these I think I'm condemned in this. You're going to have to edit this whole thing, completely re-edit this thing, because he's another person I didn't quite mention at the very beginning who's been very interested in this Rousseau-Nietzsche relationship, and has written, hasn't written a single book on the two of them together, but has written two books that, you know, kind of take each of these authors, but in a way that very much is trying to bring them into conversation with one another. And anyway, someone like Meyer, I think in keeping with the largely Straussian view, puts a great deal of emphasis on the Reveries as being somehow not only different from that, the Rousseau of the social contract in the Aeneid, but in some ways the more authentic Rousseau, the Rousseau where we get the real teaching of Rousseau. And my view of that is, I don't quite follow that line of thinking, that I see the Reveries as, you know, different circumstance. This is the Rousseau, you know, who's been abandoned by everybody, who's, you know, been stoned out of his house in Switzerland, and has no friends, and has no country, so on and so forth. And in some ways gives us an image of what happiness might look like in such an unfortunate circumstance as he finds himself there in the 1760s. But to me, the kind of the form that happiness takes there is still largely compatible, very much in keeping with this idea that we need to kind of bring our desires and our ability to satisfy our desires into conformity with one another, to create a kind of harmony in that way. I see that as very much of a piece of the earlier project, and I don't think it in any way repudiates it altogether leaves it behind. So there is that there, but again, I much of this is my distinctive, such as it is, but my original contribution here is to, and this is probably where I differ from Cooper as well. I tend to see the Reveries as not being the core deepest reflection on Rousseau's understanding of authenticity, but rather a kind of imagination of our happiness under extremely alienating circumstances, which in no way repudiates what Rousseau sees as, in many ways, the optimal pursuit of virtue and happiness in those other moral and political writings.
Great. So you're last substantive chapter on the positive views is on politics there, and here you really see, I think, as you put it, the biggest differences between Rousseau and Nietzsche. Rousseau, you know, famously very egalitarian thinker. Nietzsche, very famously inegalitarian, sort of aristocratic thinker. But you offer, I love your readings here. And I'm in great sympathy with both of them. You read Rousseau much more as a liberal democrat as opposed to sometimes called a totalitarian democrat. So I'm interested in you developing that. But also you read Nietzsche, much more as interested in the politics of culture as opposed to the politics of the state, and that scholars have sort of kind of run them together in unproductive ways, which I also agree with wholeheartedly. So maybe you just got to start with Rousseau, say a little bit about your kind of the liberal reading.
Yeah. So, and you have absolutely characterized it accurately. The Rousseau that Rousseau and Paul, I think I go very far in kind of making Rousseau out to be a great liberal democratic thinker. I mean, a little bit at odds with the, of course, the book begins with Rousseau as a great critic of Enlightenment liberalism, and at the end of the book, I've in some ways brought him back into the fold, and I'm very, you know, and I don't want to harp too much on the.
A frenemy of liberalism, exactly. a friendly critic. So.
That sounds like a potential title for the book, actually. Rousseau and Nietzsche, frenemies. But yeah, I don't want to harp too much. I mean, I do. There is a way in which, you know, the idea of Rousseau as, you know, totalitarian thinker, you know, is maybe something we've moved on from, and is a vestige of older scholarship. Although I would say it just keeps popping up. I mean, it never seems to go away entirely. And I think that readers, especially conservative readers of Rousseau to this very day, tend to kind of see Rousseau as an enemy of liberal democracy and some sort of collectivist or authoritarian or totalitarian thinker. So I go very much against that grain. And I this chapter is partly complementary with my is complementary with my chapter on the self, in the sense that I see the central concern of Rousseau in his ethics and his politics with this idea of self-dependence, that the greatest ill, the greatest evil that we want to avoid is dependence on others, dependence on others in the bad sense that we are controlled by, dominated by, manipulated by others. So I see the social contract. I read the social contract very much as an effort to construct politics in order to preserve that negative freedom, and I call it a kind of a negative freedom by which we are able to, not be subject to the will or the power or the domination of others, and and in that respect, I think he, that brings him very much, and democracy is very much a part of that. A certain kind of economic egalitarianism is very much a part of that. And as I put a great deal of emphasis on, the rule of law is extremely important to that enterprise of self, self freedom understood as self dependence. And just in that regard, that by emphasizing this kind of liberal understanding of Rousseau's politics, I don't ignore or I think underestimate the importance of what might be called the communitarian dimension of Rousseau's politics. But I do try to show that the communitarian dimension, you know, which puts a great deal of emphasis on education and shaping people in a certain way, and even civil religion to some extent, that those communitarian dimensions or aspects of Rousseau's political thought are always to be understood as instrumental to, ancillary to, auxiliary to this liberal project that I've described prior to this. And I suppose part of the reason for understanding Rousseau in this way is, apart from the fact that I think it's true, is that it does, I think, set off the contrast with Nietzsche even more profoundly, that in my reading, you know, maybe almost the opposite of what is often the case, Nietzsche comes off as in many ways not the hyper-individualistic political thinker, but in many ways a much more communitarian thinker who finds this idea of this kind of idea of politics as being completely in the service of keeping people independent and of one another and preserving their freedom, those kind of quintessentially liberal ideas inadequate, and that what we do need is something that brings together people together much more profoundly, integrates them much more profoundly in a common quest for a common goal that transcends the individual and his or her independence. So yeah, my Nietzsche is in that respect the communitarian in contradistinction to the more individualistic liberal Rousseau. The twist, of course, being, and this is a twist that, you know, I think we are very much on the same page on with respect to our interpretations of Nietzsche, where we see Nietzsche as, whether you call him an aristocratic thinker or a meritocratic thinker, that he's not really advocating, you know, some sort of literal aristocratic political society, but that his aristocratism is very much to be seen in cultural terms, the cultivation of excellence and of great individuals, in such a way that it is not entirely incompatible with democratic political institutions. And in this respect, I feel like we've always been very, very, I've learned a great deal from you in this regard. And I've always found your work on, you know, kind of how we understand Nietzsche's politics, such as they are, very, very useful. Where we may differ slightly, and I'll let you come back on this, but
all right, I can't wait. Yeah, good.
Well, maybe my view is that Nietzsche, in some ways, accepts the inevitability of democracy, and even imagines that we can exploit democracy, political democracy, for this cultural project of cultivating human greatness. I would never, I still would want to insist that he is no friend of democracy in that sense, that there is a way in which this is still very much cold comfort for anybody who's seriously committed to liberal democracy. I think it makes Nietzsche's project more realistically feasible in some ways. But I see, and here's where I'll let you kind of come in. You may see even greater complementarity between democracy and Nietzsche's meritocratic or aristocratic cultural project than I see coexistence, but a coexistence is ultimately in the service of Nietzsche's aristocratism. You may see something a little bit more reciprocal.
Yeah, I think in the case of liberalism, maybe not democracy, there's more possibility. I mean, in the early period, and I've written on this, I mean, I think for Nietzsche, one of the great enemies is the modern state. And so, you know, I think Nietzsche has a liberal moment in the sense that he wants to, like a good liberal, make the state as small as possible in order to fight back, in order to create more space. So the liberalism and the cultural aristocracy are, you know, there's sometimes people call it aristocratic liberalism, right? Like Jacob Burckhardt, you know, they can be complementary because if you shrink the state, you can grow the culture. But I think when you get to the later period work, and this is when I come back to you, because this is, I get a little bit more confused here, because just to put two aphorisms side by side for you, which you talk about both of these in the book. The one aphorism I'm thinking of is, I think it's in Beyond Good and Evil. I'm not sure what number it is, but Nietzsche's talking about the effect of the democratization in Europe. And his point is essentially that there is a positive effect of democratization, which is that it makes sort of effectively a crowd of small souls, which is really bad, right? Because it sounds like the leveling, all the stuff that he doesn't like. But it also points to a redemptive moment in the fact that it makes possible the sort of great individual who could rise out of this great mass and sort of form it together into a kind of supranational whole, right? So that's one side. So you could say that it's like democracy could be redeemed in that sense. And so, but on the other hand, you have this other passage that you cited, which I love, from Twilight of the Idols, where Nietzsche's at his most Burkean. He's criticizing the kind of understanding of liberal freedom as sort of individualistic freedom. And what he wants instead is what does he say, is like a will to tradition and
yes,
hierarchy and so forth. And it's a very kind of the opposite of what I just described, which is like, you know, the leveling of distinctions among human beings can allow great individuals to rise. Here he's talking about, no, I mean, and actually the will to tradition, where you have the sort of hierarchy, is actually most conducive to human excellence. And that's something I've been thinking about recently, but I can't quite figure out how to put together Nietzsche's thought, that sort of whether Nietzsche ultimately thinks at the end of the day in his late period, you know, whether democracy can actually paradoxically be more suitable to greatness, or whether, the sort of tradition, Burkean traditionalism, is more suitable. I don't know if you have any thoughts about that.
Yeah, no, that's a great question. And my way of squaring those two aphorisms would be that the latter one, Twilight of the Idols, where he talks about the will to tradition and authority and so on and so forth, might be understood as governing the relations amongst the higher types that he talks about, that he's not there talking about in some ways the whole of society, but really kind of and I think even within his higher types there's a hierarchy within that, which is of course another fascinating element of Nietzsche that stretches all the way from Schopenhauer's Educator, you know, where he'll there's always the great unwashed, but then there are, you know, those people who are, you know, kind of joined together to produce the genius, and it's there's the genius and there are the near geniuses, and then there are the folks that I always tend to see myself in terms of the second and third rate talents that are also going to, you know, kind of be part of this whole thing. And so I guess
you're a philosophical laborer. You're a philosophical laborer, I think. That's exactly where we are, right? Yeah.
Yeah. You know, and even, you know, when you go further down the road into Zarathustra, you know, when he talks about warriors and you know, the new nobility and so on and so forth, there's always seems to be still some sort of caste-like distinctions or hierarchical distinctions, even amongst those who are part of this great cultural project that he's talking about. So I guess I see the Twilight of the Idols aphorism more in terms of that, the relations of that particular group, leaving again, you know, still the handy industrious herd animal they spoke about in the first aphorism from Beyond Good and Evil, still pretty much intact and governed by more democratic relations. To me, one of the most interesting aphorisms that kind of sheds another light on this problem that you're talking about is in Gay Science. and it may be 356 or something like that, but it's the one where he talks about how Europe is becoming ever more artistic. And he talks about how, you know, we modern human beings have become extremely good actors. We can don many roles, we can put on many different costumes, we're very adaptable, and so on and so forth, very trainable, very intelligent in a lot of ways, but in this kind of not very profound way that we're constantly kind of, I mean, it has always struck me as one of the great descriptions of you know, kind of American culture, that, you know, we're just extremely adept at being one thing today and another thing tomorrow. We can shift roles at the drop of a hat. All of that to me, and then he ends that aphorism by saying, you know, this is so different from, what people were like when it was possible to create a genuine, the great edifices of the past, the great cultural edifices of the past, that this is so different. He says the one thing that we can't do any longer is create edifices or societies of the sort that we used to in the Middle Ages, let's say, for example, because what you need for those edifices is people who simply occupy one role, do one job, and are satisfied with that. So he ends that aphorism by saying, you know, what's really needed for these great edifices are stones. And one thing that we can no longer be, we modern, multifarious, play-acting individuals, is stones in a great edifice. You know, and this aphorism is, there's a tremendous controversy about what exactly does this mean? Is Nietzsche kind of capitulating? You know, has he given up on the grandiose cultural project that he had in mind or talks about elsewhere? Is he, William Connolly, I think, interprets this passage as, you know, kind of emblematic of Nietzsche's kind of how he's really a democratic thinker of sorts. My reading of that passage is, just to bring it into line with what we've been talking about, is that he's describing that, again, we're not going to be kind of create the greatness in the future along the lines that we did in the past. We don't have the personnel, the individuals, the stones that were required for those grandiose edifices. What we have are these, again, multi-purpose, handy, industrial dwarf animals. And we will have to kind of construct something grandiose out of this, but it's going to be a very different kind of grandiosity, a very different sort of edifice than the ones that we've seen in the past.
Great. So to conclude, I wanted to, just to get you to talk a little bit about your own conclusions about the significance of this dialogue between Rousseau and Nietzsche. I mean, you have some things to say in the conclusion about what they can, how they can speak to our contemporary age. I was wondering if you could just say a little bit about, what you think, how you think Rousseau can speak to us today, what his limitations are, and what you think, how you think Nietzsche can speak to us today, and what his limitations are. And I was delighted to see that you come down ultimately on Team Nietzsche in terms of who speaks more to our age. So that's good. Good. I approve.
Yeah. But we don't dislike Rousseau.
No, in fact, Rousseau is the bust of Rousseau is the image for this podcast. So I can't.
Is that right?
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah, at the very end, I think in the conclusion, I think the thing I highlight more than anything else is that what makes these two thinkers so interesting and compelling to us today is that they do address what I think has been a persistent problem in Enlightenment liberalism, and that is the sort of human being that it has produced. There's a way in which liberal democracy, it's been, there are many great things that have come from liberal democracy, and it has certainly made, a certain stability and a certain justice and a certain fairness for us. But the ideal of the human being that lies at the heart of liberal democracy has always been a little uninspiring, a little spiritually impoverished, a little flat. And it's Rousseau and Nietzsche that I think put their finger on that deficit in Enlightenment modernity, Enlightenment liberal modernity, and identify the problem. And what really makes them, from my point of view, such important writers is that they not only identify the problem, others have as well, is that they really think creatively and imaginatively about how we might address that deficit and create something that actually does, that is loftier and more compelling and richer and something to aspire to. And in the conclusion, I think that's what we learn from these writers, that they identify an important problem, and they make serious efforts to construct an alternative that might rectify the problem that they identify. The solutions have some problems. It is very hard to be, I think, wholeheartedly either a Rousseau or a Nietzschean, in the way that it may not be so hard to be a Lockean or something like that. These are, they're both extremely imaginative writers, speculative writers, and as a result, I don't think they ever offer us anything that comes to anywhere close to being an implementable blueprint. Probably more so Nietzsche than. More difficult even with Nietzsche than for Rousseau. So I guess in the conclusion, I highlight some of those difficulties. I think their ideals of the self perhaps remain, maybe the most compelling aspects of their positive projects. And as you say, I think Nietzsche's more so than Rousseau's, because I think he identifies and responds to the fundamental problem of our age, which is more so the nihilism and lack of meaning of the modern age rather than kind of bourgeois hypocrisy along the lines of Rousseau's target. We didn't talk about the chapter on women and family, and their views so interesting on this topic, and the fact that they take this question of women and family so seriously, I think is all to their credit. It's a hard mountain to climb to completely defend either of their views on this score. But I do try to say that there's something there that might be worth thinking about, at least as far as the way in which they think about difference between the sexes, as opposed to complete uniformity. and interdependence between the sexes, as opposed to the kind of individualistic model of liberalism. But that's the toughest pill to swallow. And then, of course, with respect to politics, as we've talked about before, I do come down on Team Nietzsche, strangely, weirdly, probably somewhat apart from you and a few other people. We're in a distinct, you know, most people probably would find that a rather shocking and surprising conclusion to come to. But I do think that here again, Nietzsche addresses, you know, kind of the aimlessness, the lack of purpose, the lack of overarching goal that seems to be, to me, at the heart of, you know, the crisis of modernity. And, you know, finds a more satisfying solution to it, even politically, albeit political here has to be understood in the broadest possible sense, and not simply in terms of the kind of conventional institutions of the state.
Well, that's great. It's a good place to end. Paul, it's been a pleasure to talk, and as always, good to see you. And thanks again for joining me on the Political Theory Review.
Well, thank you very much for having me, and thanks for asking those the questions that really, I don't think they got me to talk well, but they did get me to talk.
You've been listening to the Political Theory Review. Find us on the web and on iTunes. Thanks to the Starting Points Journal for partnering with us. And thanks to you for listening.